You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the Essentials of Noetic Sciences series. I'm Angela Murphy, and tonight our guest is Jeffrey Kripal. He holds the J. Newton Raiser Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University, where he is also the chair of the Department of Religious Studies. He is the author of Authors of the Impossible, The Paranormal, and the Sacred, as well as Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, in addition to a number of other papers and books, it looks like. Our host tonight is ION's Director of Research, Cassandra Featon. Welcome, Cassie.
Hi there. Thanks, Angela. And it is my pleasure to welcome Jeff Kripal to our teleseminar series. Jeff is a colleague and I would say a new friend and someone who's actually quite a brilliant and pioneering scholar in religion, humanities, science, and the place where science and spirit meet. And I'm really happy to be talking with you, Jeff, about what you're calling the third realm of knowledge. And so I just was hoping that we could start by asking you, what is this third realm?
Well, that's a phrase that actually goes back to the 19th century, and the English intellectuals who founded the London Society for Psychical Research around Cambridge were talking about something they called the tertium quid. And they liked to use Latin phrases because a lot of them were classicists. They taught Latin and Greek. And by that, they're talking about this term in the 1880s, about 20 years after Darwin. And the cultural wars at that time had really split between religion, the faith of religion, and the reason of science. And these intellectuals were looking for a way to sort of move between and beyond that polarity. And so they called it the tertium quid. So my way of talking about the third way of knowing is really just an attempt to resurrect and revise that notion and try it again.
So, Jeff, what were the first two?
The first two what? The first two ways of knowing?
The first two realms of knowledge.
Well, the most traditional one, of course, has been religion and knowing the world and human nature through the doctrines of faith. And the one that began to supplant that in the 19th century, of course, was science and the scientific method. So this notion of a third realm was, again, an attempt to move beyond that polarity.
And you talk about this third realm being a place where it is okay to talk about the paranormal. This is a place where discussion, scientific and scholarly discussion of the paranormal can take place, and it provides this arena for that which has been not safe for many people to talk about in academia and out in the world. And can you say a little bit more about kind of coming out of the closet around looking into the paranormal?
Well, yeah. The paranormal is another, well, it's a very modern term. It seems to appear somewhere around 1900. And again, it comes out of this psychical research tradition. And the reason I'm trying to revisit this is my own sense of paranormal events are, these are essentially events that involve some objective reality out there in the physical world doing something very strange. And it corresponding to some kind of mental state or some kind of psychical condition. And so by that fact that it involves both a mental state and a physical external state, it violates, you know, how we've divvied up the world, which is essentially between matter, which the sciences study, and mental states or forms of consciousness, which the humanities in a field like psychology tries to study. And those two realms aren't supposed to interact in any dramatic fashion, but in fact they do. And in our modern world, we often refer to those as paranormal phenomena. So I think these are very fruitful things, very fruitful events to think about and to work with to try to move us out of our old ways of thinking.
Now, I think when we were together last at this conference at Duke University, I took issue with your use of the word paranormal, and I know that a lot of people use that, and I think it's a great term, but it also sort of speaks to the idea that these experiences are around the normal or beyond the normal. And in some ways, I think, you know, obviously these experiences are very, very common, but they're also unique and powerful, as you say, places where mind and matter meet. And what has been some of your experience studying the paranormal and looking into the history of how that's influenced culture?
Well, I suppose my first sort of striking, you know, it wasn't a revelation or anything, but it was an insight that a lot of these experiences were the subject of great interest by major scientists and thinkers in the 19th and early 20th century, and then it just sort of falls away, or in the teens and 20s of the 20th century. And what I find when I go around the country talking about these issues today is that a lot of scientists and a lot of really smart people are just as interested in them now, but they feel like they have to stay in the closet, as it were. There's a kind of shaming or humiliation that has gone on around this topic by a number of social forces, and also, of course, all of the frankly fraudulent stuff that gets thrown in that tends to weaken the discussion as well. So there's a lot of things that are stacked up against somebody who wants to, you know, talk about these things calmly and in a balanced, intelligent way.
And so, you know, what do you make of these experiences? I think, you know, from the dualistic perspective, we've talked about this at IONS a lot, and I know you've talked about it in some of your books. You know, all of these experiences are sort of illusory, and they appear out of the realm of matter, and they seem meaningful, but perhaps they're not meaningful. And then from a religious perspective, they're sort of the essence, and matter is something to be transcended, and it's not really important. And I know that some of your work has been in the realm of sexuality, which is for where many people is one of the easiest places where they have experienced mind and matter meeting, or they might have experienced oneness or unity. And I'm wondering, you know, where do you kind of fall on the materialist versus non-materialist spectrum?
Well, you raised a lot of issues there, and I'll take your last question first. I mean, my position that I take in the book, Authors of the Impossible, is that whatever reality is, it's neither simply material nor simply mental. It's both and neither. So I take somewhat of a koan or paradoxical position on this, because I think that's precisely what paranormal events are designed to do, to be sort of living koans or riddles that can shake us out of our desire to understand everything through material processes, or everything through mental or spiritual. I think both of those are false.
And so I'll go back to my second question. How do you see sexuality referring to these things, and, you know, where do you see the role of sexuality as a place where we can talk about both realms of experience at one time?
Well, there's a couple levels there. All of my early work, you know, this is the sixth book I've written, and the first three were really all about erotic mystical literature and the ways that human beings' experience of the divine tend to be coded and expressed and probably even experienced in sexual terms. And when you try to, you know, make that observation and try to understand that in a piece of public scholarship or in a lecture, what you always get is this dualistic frame of mind that's bounced back at you, in which someone or a lot of people say, well, spirit has nothing to do with sex. The soul has nothing to do with the body. And of course, that's the traditional view of a lot of religious systems, which are explicitly dualistic. But what you see in the mystical literature over and over and over again is that's simply not true, and that people have their most profound religious experiences through sexual energies and the altered states of orgasm and arousal and all of these other things. So there what you have is a kind of dualism that is then transcended by the actual mystical experience. And I think with the paranormal, it's a very similar structure. You know, our worldview tells us that things are only material and causal, and our religions tell us that reality is primarily mental or spiritual. And what a paranormal event does is say, no, it's both. So I think on that deeper sort of metaphysical level, the paranormal is functioning very much like an erotic mystical state. It's violating our dualisms. On a simpler level, though, it is simply true that mediums and psychics and people who have these paranormal events often have them surrounded by sexual experiences or arousal, or there's something about human sexuality that can provoke these sorts of things. And to sort of give you a negative example of this, you know, the famous poltergeist, the angry ghosts of early psychical research, one of the things they realized very early on is that poltergeist phenomena tends to happen around pubescent girls or boys who are incredibly distraught emotionally or sexually, or they're being abused in some ways. So there you have a kind of negative quasi-demonic or ghostly manifestation that seems to be being driven by suppressed or frustrated or angered sexual energies. And that's not to reduce it simply to sexuality. I'm not making a Freudian argument here. I'm arguing that they're connected and that you can't understand the one without the other.
Well, yeah, and it seems like what we're talking about here is this sort of taboo terrain where matter and mind meet, and sometimes it's a very, very positive experience for people, and sometimes it's quite distressing and deconstructive. And in our own research on transformation, what we've kind of shown is that those deconstructive experiences can actually be quite powerful for the development of human potential. And so the same thing with these paranormal experiences. And I know you've been very involved in sort of chronicling the human potential movement. And how do you link these this interest in the paranormal with human potential?
Well, Let me respond to something you didn't ask, but that your reflections just provoked in me, and then we can come back to the human potential question. The subtitle of Authors of the Impossible is The Paranormal and the Sacred, and the sacred has a long history in the technical scholarship in sociology, anthropology, and the history of religions, which are the fields that I was trained in. And the first thing that you need to know about the sacred in these disciplines is that the sacred is not the good. The sacred can manifest in either positive or negative fashions. So in almost all religious systems, the sacred can heal and transform, but it can also terrify and destroy. And human beings from the primordial past have encountered the sacred as something gorgeous and beautiful and alluring, but also terrifying and scary and destructive. And I think that's why paranormal events often tend to split along these same lines. People experience angelic presences, but they also experience demonic presences. People experience alien abductions that transform them and make them more open-minded and spiritual, and people also experience alien abductions that are sexually abusive and demonic and destructive, and so I'm trying to tease out what modern people mean by the paranormal by trying to understand it in a much larger context of the history of religions and people's encounter with the sacred throughout the millennia.
Well, and before you return to the human potential question, I guess it's interesting because it sounds like where we're going here is this space that not only deconstructs the dualism between mind and matter or spirit and the physical world, but also between our ideas of what is positive and what is negative. And, you know, a question that arises for me is, you know, I think sometimes people tend to privilege the positive as sort of real and the negative as unreal. And it seems like what you're saying is it's all kind of more complex than that. You know, there isn't we're tempted to fall back into the dualism, but there's some terrain here that really transcends positive versus negative, mind versus matter.
Absolutely. And the other thing that needs to be said here is that the topic of the paranormal or the topic of psychical phenomena is not only an extremely problematic one for the orthodox or for the professional scientists, it's just as problematic or even more so for the traditional religious leaders who tend to see the paranormal as code for the devil or the demonic. So you're sort of in this between a rock and a hard place here when you're trying to understand these things.
So let's return to this question of human potential and the human potential movement. It seems that these experiences, both in individuals' lives personally and sort of culturally, have propelled the human potential movement, propelled people to seek something more or to question, what am I really capable of, or what's really going on here?
Right. I mean, look, if a 13-year-old servant girl can blow up the light bulbs in the house and set the curtains on fire just through her emotional angst, what else can she do? And if she can do it, then we probably all can do that. So there's a very simple logic there that these abilities are almost certainly in the species as a whole. They're not unique to individuals, although certain individuals might be more inclined or more gifted, just like some people are more athletic or more musical. So I think that the whole notion of human potential here is all woven in to these experiences. And I know historically that the human potential movement really, in part, comes out of these experiences. And in its early years, in the early 60s, was, really, really interested in psychical research and precisely these sorts of experiences, because they saw them as the signs or the keys of the human potential.
Well, I know that you have a personal interest in sort of the intersection of popular culture and the myth or the legend or the reality of heroes and superpowers, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. How does our societal obsession or fascination with heroes and the superpowers of particular humans kind of fit into a more serious scholarship around religion and spirituality and science?
Well, I guess I can tell a story here. I've told it before, but probably most of our listeners haven't heard it. My interest in popular culture, and in particular in science fiction and superhero comics, is partly, no doubt, a simple midlife regression. I'm in my 40s, and instead of buying a Harley or something, I'm going back to comic books, which I haven't read since I was 13. So on one level, it's just a midlife regression. On another level, I think a more serious level, though, what actually happened was in 2006, in the summer of 2006, I was finishing my history of the Esalen Institute and the Human Potential Movement, and I'd just spent, you know, 4, 5, 6 years reading about and writing about all of this psychical and paranormal stuff that flowed through Esalen. And I was, you know, I guess obsessed with it on some level. And in that summer, I went to a movie with my family, as I often do, and it happened to be third X-Men movie. And it ends, if you've seen it, on Alcatraz, right out across the bay from you, Cassie. You could probably see it from where you're sitting, or I don't know, where you're
in.
What's that?
Pretty close.
Okay, so it ends there. And while I was watching this movie, I realized that the reason I had sort of become obsessed with superhero comics at that point was that they reminded me a lot of the basic ideas of the Human Potential Movement, which basically boil down to this notion that evolution is producing or actualizing potentials in the species that are embedded in the species but haven't been fully realized yet, and that gradually we're coming to realize these human potentials. So I made this conclusion gosh, that sounds a lot like the X-Men mythology. And I finally concluded that it is the X-Men mythology, and that the X-Men and Esalen were created within a year of one another in 62 and 63, and that the Human Potential Movement really is sort of the mysticism of the system, and it develops primarily on the West Coast in California, where you're at. And the X-Men mythology and really all the superhero mythologies develop on the East Coast, really around New York. And so that what you have here is a kind of weird resonance between American mythologies being developed on the East Coast and American mysticisms being developed on the West Coast. And I thought that was really significant. I still think that's really significant. And so I wanted to explore that and see where that took me. So that's why I wrote Authors of the Impossible, which is a more expansive book on the paranormal, and why I just finished a follow-up on science fiction and superhero comics.
Tell us a little bit about Authors of the Impossible. What's it about?
Well, it's about four authors who have written very intelligent, smart things about the paranormal. The first one is Frederick Myers in the 19th century, England. The second one is Charles Fort, an American humorist and writer in the teens and 20s of the last century. And then the third is Jacques Vallée, a French-turned-American astronomer, computer scientist, and ufologist. And finally, a French philosopher named Bertrand Meust. So I picked those four authors because I thought they had the most to say. And what I try to advance in the book is this notion that the humanities can tell us something about the paranormal, too. In other words, we can use the methods of reading texts and narrative and meaning and make some sense of paranormal events.
Yeah, and in some ways it does seem that is one of the strongest ways that people make sense of these events. I know that, for example, it seems like the top 5 or 8 primetime television shows are things like Heroes and The Medium, and, you know, people are absolutely fascinated by it. And for some reason, when they appear in a storytelling format, it's a little bit more acceptable for exploration than in a scholarly or scientific context.
Well, that's right, and that's why, you know, I call this the Trojan horse method. You can't talk about these things in the churches and synagogues for the most part, but you can talk about them endlessly in movies and novels and comics and magazines. And so as a culture, you know, that's what we've done. That's where people go because they have had these experiences and they recognize echoes or exaggerations of their experiences in these television series or in these films. And I think that's precisely what makes them so popular and what drives the box office in the Nielsen ratings is that people have actually, almost everyone has had one of these experiences. And so when they see those reflected in a piece of fiction or entertainment, they get really excited.
Yeah, and it kind of makes me think, you know, in some ways it's almost like to oversimplify it, the right brain, left brain dichotomy. It's almost like it's okay to really encounter these things through the right brain or through stories and art and poetry and things like that. And when we try to sort of direct a logical or scientific lens upon them, that's when it becomes a little bit taboo and dangerous, and you know, we're not sure we want to connect these realms. You know, it seems like almost a dangerous thing to connect these realms.
Well, I actually end Authors of the Impossible with the left brain, right brain research, and with Jill Bolte Taylor, whom I'm sure a lot of folks have seen and listened to, this neuroanatomist who had this massive stroke that shut down her left side of the brain, and she basically enters a mystical state of nirvana for weeks or months, and then comes back and talks about these two modes of being that are in us all. And I actually think that's pretty much exactly what's happening. I don't think you can overuse the fact that we all have essentially two different people in us, one on the left and one on the right, and yes, they communicate and are connected in billions of ways, but they're also very different. And I think the rejection of this narrative, mystical way of being is just the left brain not wanting to tolerate the right brain, and it's, they're both in there. So I think we better get used to that.
Well, and in some ways, I think that's really what the Institute of Noetic Sciences is trying to do, and places like Esalen, is provide these communities and resources and spaces where people can go and attempt, you know, take a shot at coherence. You know,
right.
Take a shot at saying, hey, I'm one whole being. I'm really not two brains. I'm not really my head and my heart.
Right.
There isn't really mind and matter. That's not my experience. And coming up with tools and technologies and ways of speaking and languages to sort of say there is a whole place where there isn't two, there's one.
And isn't it funny, I keep saying right. I mean, even our language presumes that the right is right and the left is wrong. So, I mean, we've just been, oh, my God, let's not get going on that. But I mean, it's just embedded in us, and I think people do long and hunger for a greater wholeness or an integration, an integral nature, as the Human Potential Movement puts it.
And so have you encountered yourself or observed practices or ways of being or processes that people can engage in that sort of give them a safe space to explore the intersecting terrain? I mean, as we said, you know, sometimes when it hits you spontaneously, it's quite disturbing and quite deconstructive, and yet there are now many constructive ways to explore the terrain, or even if you've had a deconstructive experience, there are things that you can do that work with that. Is there anything that you do personally or that you've observed that you think is a really great practice or way of encountering this?
Well, I think each of these answers can only be deeply personal. My primary practice is writing, and creative writing is most definitely a left brain listening very closely and humbly to the right brain, and the two working together. So for me, that's been the way I've integrated these sorts of experiences into my own life, is to write them out, to write about them. And as a teacher, what I do is I spend about 4 months at a time with young people in a very private space called a classroom, and I create a safe space through lectures and conversation. And inevitably, when you create such a space, these young people start to tell you things, and they're inevitably extraordinary things. And then you sort of work through those things in the classroom. So those are my primary two methods. I also, by the way, get a lot of correspondence from readers who want to share something, and you know, and I try to respond to all those. So those are the three, I suppose, formats or contexts in which I try to perform this integration. But those are really unique. I mean, those are all personal. I wouldn't propose those as answers for other people.
Well, tell me a little bit about your interest in Esalen and what role you've seen Esalen play in the kind of forwarding of the human potential movement.
Well, that's a long story. I mean, I've been involved with Esalen in some form since 1998. Michael Murphy, the co-founder, the spring of 98, read my first book called Kali's Child. And it's a study of the great Hindu saint Ramakrishna and looking at these mystical and erotic themes. And Mike got very, very excited about that book and called me up late one night. And so we began to correspond, and then I went out there in the late 90s. And then sometime after the turn of the millennium, I was very struck by how rich the history was there and how important and influential it was, and that we didn't really have a full history. We had a wonderful book called Upstart Spring by Walt Truett Anderson, but that book ends in around 1980 or so. So we simply lacked a full history. And so I proposed to try to write such a book, because I'm a historian of religions by training, so that's the sort of thing I do professionally. And it was a way, you know, it was certainly a professional project, but it was also a deeply personal project. I was looking for a kind of spiritual home, having been exiled, as it were, from my native Catholicism and then Hinduism. So I was looking for a place that would embrace me, and Esalen embraced me, and so I've been very involved there since then.
And the subtitle of that book is The Religion of No Religion.
Right.
And that's always been sort of captivating to me, because I think a lot of the members of the Institute come to us because they have a deeply spiritual or sacred orientation, but they've been disillusioned with organized religion.
That's right. That phrase actually comes from a professor of comparative religion at Stanford who taught both Michael Murphy and Dick Price, the two founders. And Frederick was a German, he's a German historian of religions like myself. When he was in the seminary, he was a young man in 1917, he was walking through a wheat field in Holland and had a profound experience of the divinity of the whole universe. But it was an experience of God in and as nature. And as he continued on this walk, he came upon a little gray church, and he was absolutely horrified by the sight of this church, because he knew that the cosmic being that he had just known directly could not possibly be stuffed in that little building or its teachings or its history. And so he developed this notion of the religion of no religion, which essentially is what people mean today when they say I'm spiritual but not religious. It's a very, very similar notion, only for Spiegelberg it was the title of his first book. So I took that notion and argue essentially that that's one of the many things that have flowed through Esalen and made it what it is today. And I would guess IONS would be serving a very similar community and a very similar group of people.
Well, and, you know, Houston Smith is another great religious scholar, and he teaches at Esalen. And he's also had some critiques of the sort of new wave of spirituality. And although he sees the commonality among religions, and he's one of the pioneers of doing that, he's used the phrase cut flower traditions to mean that some of the sort of new amalgamations of long-standing religions in some ways have sort of a cut flower feeling. In other words, they're beautiful, but where are the roots? And how do you respond to that? I mean, what do you think about kind of the new forms of encountering the sacred and, you know, the ways that they they might have these wonderful strengths of being free from dogma, but also perhaps lack roots somehow.
Well, I think that's probably true in a lot of cases, but I think you have to understand the broad history. You have to understand that if, for example, you compare Tibetan Buddhism to Sri Lankan Buddhism, they look nothing alike. And so when Buddhism moves from India into Nepal and Tibet, over hundreds and hundreds of years, it fuses with a thousand different things. It amalgamates, and it ignores a thousand other things, and then it becomes its own thing. And the same is true with any religious tradition that moves or that is alive. And so from my perspective, you know, these flowers, A, they need to be cut, because a lot of those roots are pretty dark roots when it comes to, you know, being a woman or being a free-thinking individual or living in a democratic society. There's a lot in the religions that I don't think we want to keep. So I think we have to recognize that for a truly a living religious system is always amalgamating, it's always assimilating, it's always rejecting. And we also have to recognize that people will become spiritual but not religious, not because they're somehow anti-religious or they're flippant or they're superficial. It's almost always because they've been deeply, deeply hurt or disillusioned by their native tradition. So I think that's the real driver of this, and I think we have to recognize that and see it as an honest, usually an honest, sincere response to their own lives. I'm reminded here, I gave a retreat actually to some Quakers out on the East Coast this last spring, and we were talking about this very thing. And after the conversation, this elderly woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Well, you know what we say about being spiritual and being religious?" And I said, "No, I don't." She says, "Well, being religious is for people who believe in heaven and hell, and being spiritual is about people who have been to hell and have come back." And I think that's exactly right. I think she's right.
Well, my last question for you before we open it up to the people who are on the call to ask questions is, you know, you said that you've taken a very kind of scholarly, intellectual, historical approach to exploring these things for yourself, and yet I know that your work has been kind of very focused on and extremely embodied, and I don't know, I would say maybe like a down and dirty spirituality, you know, like just the deepest, darkest corners. And you can either answer personally or sort of on a more scholarly level. What do you see as, like, you know, how can people who really want to be a thinking person and encounter the sacred at the same time bring those things together?
Cassie, I heard you say people who want to be a stinking person. you said thinking, right?
Yes.
So I understand the question here, because I've obviously already misunderstood it. What are they trying to bring together, these thinking
people?
Well,
I'm thinking about, I just was sort of intrigued by the way that you talked about your personal path being quite scholarly and in some ways, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but intellectual or a historical approach or a very analytic approach to all of these things. And I think that's a real... Obviously, it's something that I really love to do. You know, I love to take a look at it with a flash, you know, with a flashlight, and take it apart and see what it's made of. And I guess I'm just curious about the connection between that and a more embodied or experiential way of exploring these things, and just what your experience has been through all of these interviews and studies, and in your own personal life about bringing those two things together.
Well, I certainly hope nothing I've written is too scholarly or too, I mean, I didn't use those words, and I nothing I have ever written has come from anywhere other than a kind of brutal honesty, and often from my own bodily experiences and mystical experiences, frankly. And I've written about all of that. I've been very confessional in my work. I've probably revealed more about myself than anyone I know, and probably more than anybody wants to know, you know. So that's probably what you're referring to when you describe it as down and dirty, which I take as a compliment. I think we have to get beyond these taboos that have pushed this stuff under the rug. And if my work is intellectual or scholarly in any sense, it's really because I want intellectuals and opinion makers to take this stuff more seriously and to quit dismissing it and to quit taking on these arrogant, silly responses that take us nowhere. So I suppose I'm picking a fight with people I think who need to be answered, and my hope is always, though, that you know, you're just the intelligent reader will read something and say that's right, and recognize himself or herself in it. That's really my hope.
Beautiful. Thank you. Well, I think this is a great time to open the call to people who have questions.
Sure.
All right. We will do that. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Jeff Kripal, or host, Cassandra Beaton, simply press 1 on your phone keypad now. We do have a lot of callers on the line, so we ask that you keep your comments and questions concise to give more listeners a chance to talk. Again, just press 1 on your phone keypad, and we'll try to get to as many people as possible. And I will let you know when you have the mic. Sophia and John, oops, hold on, sorry. Oh, wrong name, I apologize. Sophia and John, you don't want the mic. Nahid, you have the mic.
Yes, hi. My question from Jeff is, you talk about these experiences are very personal, and even though several times the question was, what would you suggest how people would go through these personal experiences? You said the experience is mine, and I cannot say that. So I'm asking, could you share one of your experiences being in hell?
Being in hell?
Yeah. You talk about religion is knowing about hell and heaven, and spiritual is about being in hell. So my question is, going through this mystical aspect, or whatever they call it, the dark night of the soul, what was like your own personal experience being in the other side, that which was uncomfortable, and that where people are not excited to go, and there is no willingness to move and go beyond what is familiar?
Right. When I was actually quoting my Quaker friend there about going to hell. I wasn't referring to any of my own experiences there.
I understand that.
What she meant, though, she didn't mean a dark night of the soul. She did not mean a demonic encounter or anything. What she meant was that her Quaker community, and certainly she herself, had suffered tremendously because of their religious upbringing and what they had been told, particularly around, in this case, being a woman and being subordinate to men and on and on and on. And so that, I think that's what she was referring to. In my own experience, you know, I can't say I've ever been to hell, but I've known a lot of people and worked with a lot of people who have suffered tremendously for, you know, being gay or you know, not being transgendered or something. I think a lot of these experiences involve the body and our sexuality. So I think that would be, you know, and I know that's not my experience of being hell. That's what you asked about. But I've never personally been to hell or had such an experience, although, you know, I did more or less leave my birth tradition for all sorts of reasons that were painful.
Thank you for that. When you said it's something to do with the bodily experience and sexual experience, I am a woman, and I come from Middle East, and I know what the hell is for that or to be a woman. But to me, I have been in hell. But the hell, for me, it hasn't been the way that the culture or men treat women. The hell is to be able to willingly step beyond the mind and what is comfortable and what we know. And we, if we could do that, then we are we step inside of that flow, that energy, which sexuality is one of them.
Yeah.
And then that's where the experience is. But how many people are willing to go there?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds to me like you're referring to a very profound experience, and I'd want to hear more about that. I've never had such an experience like that. I mean, I've had an out of body experience that was terrifying. So maybe that's the closest I could come to what you're referring to there. But
what I'm saying, being in the body, not out of the body.
Yeah.
Is more profound, and it is where it would take us to the flow, to that mystical experience.
Yeah.
To the awareness which lies within our own feelings, being in the flow of the energy.
Yeah.
I
feel a lot of humility before your narrative there, because I can sense it's profound, but I don't claim to understand it.
It is not something to be understood, experienced. Thank you for the time.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
All right. Thank you, Naheed. Our next question is from Colette. Colette, you have the mic.
Yes, thank you. Jeff, I'm really looking forward to reading your book. It just sounds fascinating.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
You should probably buy multiple copies for all your friends and relatives, too.
I know plenty of people that would love it. Now, so my question is, and this was partially mentioned on another recent call, the part about how we go about our daily lives, and especially when we go to work and you know, it's kind of like there's so many of us that are living these almost like secret lives. Like if people that I worked with, you know, in the corporate world knew some of the experiences that I've had. And if, you know, I just look like, I mean, just to see me, I look like sort of an average California girl, I guess, or whatever that means. But, you know, no one would know some of just the extraordinary experiences I've had. And also I feel like, you know, of course, until I really kind of get a sense of from someone else what they're about or what their level of openness is, then, you know, I'm not going to necessarily talk about it. But I guess my question is, do you think that it's going to take some major earthly event or something to really get people to be more open and willing to look in, you know, outside of what, I mean, my favorite bumper sticker is question reality. And so to get people to, like, really look at and believe that there's things outside of the traditional so-called norms that we've all been brought up with.
So the question is, what's it going to take? Is that
basically.
The question?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, basically.
I don't really know. I mean, you're asking me to, well, it's a legitimate question, and I don't have an answer. But I would say this, which is not an answer, that this is what is so attractive about the superhero myths again, is that, you know, you're essentially Clark Kent working at the Daily Planet, and you have this astonishing, unbelievable secret identity, but you're keeping your glasses on, as it were, and you're not showing your cape. And so what I think's important is that you find other ex-women and ex-men like yourself, and you talk, and so you don't feel quite so alone, and you don't feel quite so strange. But what it's going to take for the broader culture, I think it's going to have to the opinion elites who control the culture, who control the media, who control the universities, who control. And I'm not. This isn't a conspiracy theory that I'm offering here. It's just I think the opinion elites of the culture have to be persuaded or moved, and they may never be moved or persuaded. You know, as someone once said, science advances one funeral at a time. And that may be the case here. It may be a generational thing.
So, for example, there's still, you know, there's a lot of conversation about 2012 and,
yeah,
you know, what might happen there. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I think that's a hope. I don't think that, I mean, I don't, yeah, I'm extremely skeptical that anything will happen in 2012 other than a lot of people being disappointed, you know, because that's... These things come about every decade, it seems like now,
yeah.
And I think we have to be smarter than that. And if we want change, we have to make that change. We can't wait for, you know, some magical event in a particular year. So I, you know, my response is much more practical. It's just to get down into the trenches and to work for this You know, I don't know. I don't even know if I wanted to capture the culture because, you know, I don't want to tell people what reality is either because I don't know. I just want there to be more openness and for the culture to be less dominated by fundamentalism and materialism, which are really two sides of the same coin, I think.
I agree.
So that none of that's an answer, Colette, but I guess I don't have an answer. I mean, if a UFO lands on the White House lawn tomorrow, that's going to have reverberations. But I don't believe that either, you know. So it's sort of like 2012, isn't it?
Well, I'm very thankful for Noetic Sciences because, you know, it's, in fact, I moved up to, I live in Petaluma. I moved up here from Marin because I wanted to, you know, get more involved. And
yeah.
You know, it's so helpful to have people that you can interact with and have conversations with without them looking at you like really strange.
Well, you see, IONS is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's in the trenches. It's trying to inform and persuade opinion elites. It's going after the sciences themselves and trying to work from within that paradigm. And I think that's the way to go. But the downside of that is you need a lot of patience and you need a lot of stamina. You got to really stick with it.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Colette. We are now taking the mic to Edwina. Edwina, you have the mic.
I'd like to ask you, what were you experiencing in your own life that made you want to research and know more about this subject?
Which subject? The paranormal?
The paranormal.
Well,
something triggered it, didn't it?
Yeah. It was both gradual and triggered. It was gradual in the sense that I had been listening to stories like this for, you know, 6-7 years as I wrote the Esalen book. But, you know, like most people, I have these moments of synchronicity, and there was one very funny minor synchronicity that happened that sort of triggered the book project. But it, you know, it wasn't particularly profound, but it was enough to trigger the project. And so, I mean, you know, and I have, you know, and I've had and have written about some fairly major dramatic experiences involving sleep paralysis and out-of-body experiences and erotic energies. And those have always been in the back of my mind when I work on this material because those are how I connect intuitively and sympathetically to these stories and these thinkers. So I guess it's all kind of in the mix there, but I hear these stories all the time, and I'm kind of shocked by how they're ignored or dismissed, and so that's sort of part of the project too.
Well, I have been very, very interested in this subject for many, many years.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, yesterday I was turned 78.
Wow.
Back in 1963, I had a dream, and it was so real. It shook me up so bad, I had this pain in the pit of my stomach. I was standing over a body in a bed, which I could not identify. All I could say was, oh, my God, how swollen. And I didn't know what it was. And about 2 days later, I was called to the emergency room at the hospital. And the dream that I had, so real, was right there. I found myself saying the very same words. This triggered a search for me because I used to ask myself, do you really think that there is a God? Do you really think there is such a thing as having a dream? Why did that happen to me? What did I do wrong? What did I do right? And yet, as it turned out, I was the one that wound up taking care of my mother and my young sister.
Yeah.
So it was like, for me, it was like I was being prepared for what I was going to do.
Yeah. Your story is so, it's so profound, and it's so similar to other stories. There's a beautiful book called The Secret History of Dreaming by Robert Moss, and he has a chapter in there on Mark Twain. And I don't know if you know the story of Mark Twain, but he had a dream just like yours of his brother's corpse on a metal casket with a bouquet of white flowers with a single red one in the middle. And 2 days later, his brother was killed in a steamboat accident. And when he arrived at the dead room, he saw his brother in a metal casket with a bouquet of white flowers, no red one yet. And as he watched and remembered his dream, a woman came in and put a single red flower in the middle of the bouquet. So, you know, clearly you had a precognitive dream like Twain's.
Had many, many, many more.
Yeah. Well, those are wonderful. I mean, what they mean to me is that we're connected to the world and to each other in ways that we can't even fathom.
It led me to a lot of research, just like you. And
yeah.
I came across a book that, I think the original printing was in 1900. And you may not know the name, Ralph Waldo Trine, T-R-I-N-E.
Oh, sure. I know it.
Oh, do you?
In Tune with the Infinite or something?
Huh?
In Tune with the Infinite?
In Tune with the Infinite.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have that copy, and I read it. And everything in these new books that I've been buying asks the questions that are in, the answers are in Ralph Waldo Trine's book.
That's great.
It's an amazing... You have to sort through the language of that time.
Yeah,
like
sure.
Waldo Emerson. And the other morning I said to myself, I wonder if Ralph Waldo Emerson really wrote this, and why did he put Trine? Because Emerson's writings are also very, very precognitive,
yeah.
Very wise.
Yeah.
And in a way, not religious necessarily, but definitely spiritual.
Oh, yeah. Well, Emerson was the father of I'm spiritual but not religious in many ways.
And so
yeah.
People have been aware of this since way back in the 1700s.
Yeah.
His book was, 1795, the first printing of Emerson's essays. And I have the entire works.
Yeah.
So, you know, I look at that and I think, why have we been so sound asleep? We have this ability, and it
right.
is an ability that Trine talks about throughout his book.
Right.
We have that within us to do. And so you take that and you ask yourself and anybody around you, How has religion failed us? Why? Because Prine's book definitely empowers you.
Right.
But we have never felt empowered by the church. In fact, I've never heard a priest or a minister even refer to something Jesus said when he said, "These things that I do, ye shall do also, and even greater things shall you do, because I go to my Father," meaning going within, because according to him, the kingdom of God is within us. That certain something that makes us tick is the soul part of us, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for those comments, Edwina. We have run over time, and I'm going to give the mic back to Cassie.
Well, I am just so fascinated by this discussion, and I could go on forever, which is why I do what I do. And thanks, everyone, for who had questions. And for those of you who didn't, you can probably engage in one of our discussion forums at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I'm sure Jeff would be willing to hear some of your comments by email. And Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. It's been just
hey, thanks for having me, everybody. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.